This is a production of Cornell University.
Hello and good evening, everybody. My name is David Abrahams, and I'd like to welcome everybody and say thank you very much for attending this event. This has been an event that we've been looking forward to for a few years, and to be honest, we want to give our sincere thanks to Justice Sears for agreeing to talk this evening. I'm not going to belabor you with a lot of talk, but I want to say thank you. And, you know, one of the things that I think this event symbolizes is the spirit of cooperation. And just to demonstrate just how many people came together to make this happen, I want to thank the Cornell Atlanta Alumni Association, the Cornell Black Alumni Association, College of Human Ecology, the Law School, the Law Association, the Cornell University Minority Alumni Programs, and Cornell's own Southeast Regional Office for making this happen. If any of the committee members are here, I'd ask them to stand up, because without their hard work, this event would not have taken place either. So if you're on the committee, please stand. You know, I think this is exciting times right now in the United States. You can hardly turn on the television without seeing something about what's going on with the presidential primaries. And one of the, I would say, dominant themes is change that you hear from the candidates. Well, same thing is true about Cornell. I think you can hardly walk around the university, for those that have been back up there, without seeing change all over the campus. And, you know, we have a new president that is very engaging with the students. You know, we've embarked on this $4 billion capital fund campaign. But in addition to that, I think one of the themes for us that has come out of not only change at Cornell, but is one of collaboration. We witnessed this by the number of organizations that came together to make this happen. And we also look at some of the things that are going on the university itself. You know, we have a collaboration between the medical school and the Cornell University campus for the faculty, where there's seed money that's been made available for the faculty to work together. We have a collaboration with ILR and Human Ecology in doing studies. We have additional collaborations that are going on between Human Ecology and the law school, where we have a combined degree that's there. But one of the things that I'm about to do is introduce a gentleman that's not unfamiliar with change, as well as being on the forefront of collaboration, and that's Dr. Charles Brainerd, who is currently right now the head of Human Ecology.
Head of the Law of Psychology.
Okay, thank you. And I'm not going to belabor that point much, but I want to welcome him up here, because he will be doing the introductions from this point on. And if we could have a round of applause for Dr. Brainerd. Thank you.
Before I begin my remarks, I'm supposed to announce two things. First thing, the proceedings are being filmed and digitized tonight, and they're going to be available just for a couple of mouse clicks on the Cornell website. And what's the link? Cornell?
Human.cornell.edu. So it's the Human Ecology website.
The Human Ecology website, and you should be able to find it. And then secondly, in the question and answer period for Justice Sears afterwards, please use the microphones. There's one there, and is there one over here? Okay, thank you. Well, having said that, good evening, and to all of you and fellow Cornellians. Thank you all for coming. as you heard, my name's Chuck Brainerd, and I'm a professor in the College of Human Ecology. I'm here this evening in my capacity as head of Cornell's program in law psychology and human development. And I'm here to do a couple of very pleasant things. The first thing is to introduce our distinguished guest, the Honorable Leo Ward Sears. And second, I'm also here to say a few brief words about what we're doing up at Cornell in law, psychology, and human development. Taking my first pleasant task first, Leo Ward Sears is, as you know, Chief Justice of the Georgia Supreme Court. But let's begin a bit further back. She was born in Heidelberg, Germany, where her father was a colonel in the United States Army and was stationed there at the time. She's a fellow Cornellian, of course, having graduated from our College of Human Ecology. To say that her undergraduate career was illustrious was a bit of an understatement. The one thing I want to say about it is that she was tapped for membership in Quill and Dagger as a senior. That's the highest extracurricular scholastic honor that's within the reach of Cornell undergraduates. Along with Yale Skull and Crossbones, it's probably the most prominent honorary society of its type in American higher education. Since leaving Cornell, Judge Sears' career has been even more illustrious. First, she went to law school, completing her JD here at Emory University. And later, she completed a Master's of Law at University of Virginia. And she, an honorary Doctor of Laws has been conferred on her by Morehouse College. After law school, Judge Sears did trial work with the firm of Alston Byrd before being appointed to the bench by Mayor Andrew Young. In 1988, she was the very first African-American woman in the state of Georgia to become a Superior Court judge. 4 years later, Judge Sears' accomplishments on the bench were recognized by Governor Zell Miller, who appointed her to the Georgia Supreme Court. When she was sworn in, Judge Sears became the Supreme Court's first woman justice and also the youngest justice to sit on the court. In 2005, Judge Sears was elevated to Chief Justice, becoming the only African-American woman Chief Justice in the United States. Throughout her career, Judge Sears' service to both the legal profession and the community has been vast. For instance, she's chaired the American Bar Association's Board of Elections, the Judicial Section of the Atlanta Bar Association, DeKalb County's Alimony and Support Unit Committee, Probation Committee, and Domestic Violence Task Force, and the Atlanta Bar's Minority Clerkship Program. Judge Sears serves on Cornell's Women's Council and Morehouse College's Board of Directors, and on the Morehouse School of Medicine Center for Child Abuse and Neglect, on the Board of Visitors of Mercer Law School, and on the Board of Missouri of Mission New Hope. She also founded the Columbus, Georgia Battered Women's Project. Now, not surprisingly, the honors that Judge Sears has received for her judicial and public service are numerous. Here are just a few examples. The Atlanta YMCA has named her one of its outstanding women of achievement, and she was named one of the 100 most influential Georgians by Georgia Trend magazine. She has received the American Bar Association's Margaret Brent Award, which honors women lawyers of unusual achievement. And she has received the Excellence in Public Service Award of the Georgia Coalition of Black Women. Judge Sears is also a former Rosalind Carter Honorary Fellow in Public Policy at Emory University's Institute on Women's Studies. Well, turning to my second pleasant task, saying a word or two about Cornell's program in law, psychology, and human development. There are deep parallels, actually, between what we do in this program and some of Judge Sears' work. In both her scholarly work and her activities on the court, Judge Sears is widely known as an articulate authority on issues that affect children and families, such as the importance of marriage, problems of adolescent pregnancy, problems of child health, the impact of divorce on children, and a number of related issues. Speaking as a researcher, what has impressed me most as I've studied some of Judge Sears' statements on these issues is that she has founded her views squarely on the best available science. In the Law, Psychology, and Human Development program, we're in the business of providing the data on which Judge Sears relies. and we're in the business of training scientists who know how to conduct the necessary research. This is part of a larger movement in the law that's known as empirical law, which aims to underpin legal practice with the very best research on human behavior and on human social institutions. Like Judge Sears, many of us at Cornell have a particular interest in research that focuses on the problems that confront children and families. Indeed, our faculty members have long been recognized as world leaders in such research. However, research on how all this affects the law, for instance, research on the special qualities of child witnesses, or on how criminal prosecutions affect families, is quite new, and there is a desperate need to train the first generation of scientists who will devote their lives to such research. That is what we've come together to do in the Law, Psychology, and Human Development program. Because the field is so new, so is our program. We're just in our infancy. But a few years down the road, we trust that you'll be hearing great things about our graduates and their research programs, things that will make you proud all over again of being from Cornell. Well, I've talked quite long enough, and you're no doubt anxious for the main course. So without further ado, let's give a warm Cornell welcome to Chief Justice Lee Award Sears.
Thank you very much, Professor Brainard, for that very warm and gracious introduction. Your program sounds really exciting. I'm not sure. It's so cutting edge. You know, there are seven people on our court, and some of the judges are a little more stuck in their ways than other judges, and I wonder how that would be received today. But you're certainly on the cutting edge, and I'm very curious about the program because, as you've seen from the work that I've done, that's almost all that I've tried to do when I wasn't just reading cases. So I applaud you. Is this a budding area in other schools, or is Cornell leading the way in this?
Cornell is really the leader.
That's fantastic, as it is in so many other areas, and that's why I'm so proud to be a graduate. Well, good evening to you all, and thank you very much for asking me to invite you to address you this evening. Before I get started, I want to give a special thanks to Dr. David Abrams and to Karen Weiss for organizing this wonderful event. Although we are far, far, far from Ithaca, I must say I see so many familiar faces here tonight. It's almost a shock because it is just, March, and it's fairly warm outside, and it's not like it is in Ithaca, I would imagine. So I still feel like I'm a little bit back on campus here. I did graduate from Cornell with a degree in Human Development and Family Studies. The foundation I received from that course of study has in many ways influenced my interest in today's topic. So I'm going to get into the future of marriage, which is something that I've used the power base that I have as the Chief Justice of Georgia to weave something I've been fascinated with for a long time, and then I'll be glad to open it up for questions and we can just chat. You know, in the last 25 years that I've had the honor to serve as a jurist in Georgia's judicial system, I have learned that in a large and growing parts of our society today, children have guns, and they have drugs, and they are having babies. In large parts of our society, children are lonely, they are abandoned, and they are insufficiently educated, even insufficiently clothed and fed. And in large parts of our society today, too many children are being born to single and often, but not always, poor women with little, if any, input from the men who fathered them. Since I left Cornell many years ago, we have created a world that is not particularly hospitable to children and that diminishes the role of men as fathers. Now, as I thought of this phenomenon and my belief that the weakening institution of marriage is largely responsible for many of these ills, I wondered whether in the years since I graduated, I have just become old and old-fashioned about parenting, about children, and about marriage. Maybe so. But I've also learned that when you are elected to do a job, as I have been, and when that job involves family matters, as my job certainly does, every day, 24/7 sometimes, you have a solemn duty and maybe even a moral imperative not to be silent, but to speak the truth to people, to speak the truth as I see it, and so that's what I'm doing. So let's just start with the basics. Fragmenting families are flooding our court dockets. Since I became a trial judge in 1989 on the Fulton County Superior Court, the percentage of domestic relations cases has risen sharply. Those cases now account for 65% of all civil cases in Georgia at the Superior Court level. Last year, more than 14,000 children were in the care of the Georgia Division of Family and Children Services, and nearly 24,000 were admitted to a youth detention center. One out of every four Georgia children under age 18 years old right now has a case with the Office of Child Support Enforcement. Now, nationwide, 70% of juvenile delinquents come from single-parent homes. And the Census Bureau reports that the percentage of Georgia families with children living below the poverty level jumps from under 18% to almost 43% if there is no father present in the household. Moreover, a new study to be published in April will show that the cost of divorce and unwed childbearing alone cost the state of Georgia more than $1 billion a year. $1 billion a year. These figures are typical of what is happening throughout the nation. For judges, they represent a difficult workload. For families, they represent an astonishing level of necessary but intrusive government oversight. For government also, they represent a mountain of resources that could be used for other purposes. But for children, these statistics are a tragedy. Last year, for the first time in history, it was reported that less than half of U.S. households were headed by married couples, and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention released data showing that almost 36% of all births are the result of unmarried childbearing these days. So that's 70% of the African American community, the highest percentage ever recorded. In family law, as in the rest of American society today, there is an intensifying debate about how we should respond to this kind of news. Should law and society actively seek ways to support marriage? Or should family law strive to be marriage neutral by providing more rights and benefits to alternatives to marriage, such as cohabitation and single parenthood? Some family law experts argue that our most pressing need is to find ways to equally support a wide variety of family forms. For example, the respected American Law Institute, that's ALI, and an organization of judges, lawyers, and legal scholars, of which I am a member, that this organization drafts model laws and other proposals for legal reform, has proposed a new set of laws that promotes a family diversity model. Some of the Institute's scholars argue that family law should focus less on trying to channel people into marriage and more on being fair to people in different relationships. In other words, that family law should take families as it finds them. Now, I'm not a law professor, but from my position as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Georgia, A family law that fails to encourage marriage ignores the fact, the empirical facts, that marriage has long now been associated with an impressively broad array of positive outcomes for children and for adults alike. Experts now who contend that we need to move beyond marriage say that they are only responding to the facts on the ground. But here is one major fact that I think that they are neglecting, and that is this one. High rates of non-marital child rearing is hurting our children. For example, studies have consistently shown that children raised outside of marriage suffer disproportionately from physical and mental illness. They are more likely to drop out of school and abuse drugs or alcohol. More of them engage in violence or suffer it in their own homes. They are less likely to attend college. Studies also show that children in single-parent families, children born to unmarried mothers, and children in step families or cohabitating relationships face higher risks of poor outcomes. Of course, many hardworking single parents do an excellent job of raising children, and they need and deserve our support as well. Take it from me, a woman who divorced herself over 10 years ago and reared two children for 4 years on my own and remarried. So I'm in a blended family as well. But I believe that building a viable, healthy marriage culture in America is still the best thing we can do for our children. And I am not alone. For example, in the recently published book, Reconceiving the Family, 24 family law scholars, including two other state Supreme Court chief justices, are critical of the American Law Institute's report. And an institute that I'm on the board of directors of, the Institute for American Values, it's a think tank in New York City, recently published a statement signed by over 30 family law scholars that concluded that a prime goal of family law should be to identify new ways to support marriage as a social institution so that each year more and more children are protected by being raised within the marital unions of their parents. To that end, a couple of years ago, the Georgia Supreme Court, under my leadership, established a commission. The commission is on children, marriage, and family law, with an important goal, and that is to find ways to reduce unnecessary divorce and unmarried childbearing. As a judge, I am often frustrated that I must work within a system designed only to pick up the pieces after families have fallen apart or failed to come together to the detriment of their children. Faced with the choice of putting our resources in the playpen or in the state pen, I've always thought that the former was the wiser choice. We must work to prevent family fragmentation because the consequences for our children and for our society are quite grave. If we look to solutions, I believe that we will find them. What we do not yet know how to accomplish, we must learn how to accomplish. I think that Americans have always believed that problems, no matter how difficult, should be addressed and not merely endured. Whether it is racism or crime or poverty, Americans, I always thought, believe that we can find ways to make a difference. Accepting the decline of marriage as inevitable means giving up on far too many of our children, and I personally believe that they deserve better than that. So with that, these are my remarks, and I'll just open it up for anything you have to say. Thank you. Normally I'd walk out and walk around and come back here, but this is being videotaped, so I'm told I need to stay kind of behind. I can be more flexible, but are there any questions for me on anything? My years at Cornell, my family, my children that I'm still trying to get up, they're 14 and 21, anything at all, I'm open. Yes, sir. Yeah. Okay.
This must have been designed by somebody in the government. Lee, I want to thank you very much for your comments. I heard you at Rotary 10 years ago.
Oh.
And just to remind the Cornell, I'm 61, so I'm one of the fossils in the audience
okay.
here. I went to a wonderful Cornell alumni thing down at the Commerce Club, and if I'm not mistaken, a lawyer from Southern Asbel in the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals had something to do with Brown versus Education or one of those big decisions in the South.
Probably, and Tuttle, probably
Tuttle,
Elbert
yeah, Judge Tuttle.
Tuttle,
right.
Yeah.
Just for everybody to know.
It wasn't, I don't know if it was Brown, but there were a lot of cases that he
right.
that the whole thing, they really right. did a fine job.
Well, I came to
okay.
Cornell on a Greyhound bus, now
okay.
having been there as an engineering student, and I got off with my IBM card, and 5 years, 4 years later, I got off and went to med school. But I started as an engineer, and the dean said, two or three of you aren't going to be here, you know, 2 years from now. And sure enough, 2 years from now, I was in the art school doing my pre-med.
Okay,
But when I left Cornell and started, you know, traveling and whatnot later in life, I was amazed at how Cornell is everywhere in the world. I mean, you go to a hotel down there in Peter Island in the Bahamas and in the Caribbean, and the hotel is from Cornell. You read about the Indian rice crop that got reevaluated and saved a lot of the folks in India. You came out of the ag school, and you look at SDS and some of that Star Wars stuff was our engineering. So, and I went back to my 40th, and they were talking about nanotechnology. So it's been they're bringing these things together. Okay, to get to your thing about marriage, I'm not ashamed to say I'm a Republican in a red state. And I'm a retired physician, and I think this thing of marriage is a big thing. It gets glossed over by the media. You know, media sells with sex and violence and all that jazz. But this recent thing about, you know, SDS and kids with, you know, 50% girls, it's a big number. And as a retired physician, what are we doing to do this? I mean, are we gonna have to fine or tax males for leaving their seed behind? Are we going to have to put birth control in the orange juice? I mean, I'm serious.
Okay.
I mean, as a retired physician, I've said for a long time, put birth control for age 15 to 35, and Advil for 35 to 55, and Elavil for 65
yeah.
and on. I mean, you know, buy your orange juice, vitamin D, and all
yeah.
the stuff you need. But I mean, we need to be serious about this. It gets into the, you know, the ethnic thing. It gets into the cultural thing. It gets into the finances. Abortion of the whole nine yards. But I think as Cornellians, my original comments were we've done so much. We've crossed so many boundaries. And I really enjoyed the Mosaic thing here several months ago. I think that your minority groups in Cornell are trying to do things that other universities aren't doing. I'm proud of the university for doing that. But what are the practical things we can do? And don't be afraid to say them. I think a lot of us are trying to be politically correct, and we just won't say things, and we need to stand up and be heard. I mean, there are things that need to be done. And
yeah.
If you're Murphy Brown, you wouldn't have six kids at $10 million a year, fine, have six kids. But if you're
I wouldn't even agree with that.
If you're a working gal with 20 grand a year,
I don't think you
can't do it.
Well, no, I don't agree with that because I've been very careful because I don't think it's any better because they're real racial and I don't think it's any better for a white woman who's doing well to make that choice than a poor black woman to make that choice, because I believe very strongly that fathers count, and to make just because you have money that the father should be in the home.
I agree.
And Murphy's, I don't remember if the, I don't even who fathered Murphy Brown's kid. It's been, what, this is the 80s, but it's for me, it's not just a money thing. It's men count, women count, and I think children need their fathers and their mothers as much as possible. I'm not advocating a return to Ozzie and Harriet, and definitely not to the 50s. The 50s were not a good time for folks like me. You know, what I'm trying to do is find a middle ground. You know, I think the pendulum has swung too far. In the state of Georgia, you can get a divorce in 31 days. I'm really concerned particularly about my community. When I was born in 1955, I'm 52, 20% of the children being born to blacks were out of wedlock. It's 70% now. And how did that happen? Things have gotten better, not worse, I think. So we have to turn these things around. But I'm working very hard not to make it a, if you're rich, you can do whatever you want. If you're poor, you have to follow the rules kind of thing. And that's why I think I've been so well received in giving this message. It was tough at first. Everyone, I don't believe in marriage if there's domestic violence and, you know, all the footnotes, I can keep going on. And I can also just shut up because there are a lot of times when divorce is necessary. But I still wanted to take it on. It was very difficult at first. But after a while, people understood.
So come you're to saying it's too easy. That's the whole
it's
thing.
Way too easy.
So how do you reverse that?
We start talking. Everyone shies away. You know, you don't even hear people talking about it anymore. Marriage is a bad word. It's a nasty word. You know, people have children, and you're afraid to say, does he look like the father, your husband, because most likely he's not the husband. We don't talk about it. My mother told me not to take this up. She said, you're going to get tarred and feathered. She's 78 years old. She said it's a good thing to take up, but nobody, our friends, oh God, no, please don't do this. But it's been very well received among all kinds of blacks and whites, and it's interesting. So many people are creeping out of the closet afraid to talk about it because, you know, it's not politically correct. It's sort of a diversity, but, you know, diversity can go too far, you know, where we just accept everything. And that's what we're doing. We're teaching our children everything goes. I don't think that's what we mean. Okay, anyway, thank you. We'll meet again. Let me go on this side.
Justice Sears, I'm Rick Warnecki. I was also born in 55,
okay.
By the way.
Oh, good.
I want to offer a couple of things. I hate to do this and take mic time, but thanks to everybody for coming tonight. It's wonderful when we have, and I thank mostly for you for coming tonight. I'm on the board. And it's wonderful when we have somebody like you that brings out so many people. I met a chemical engineering colleague of mine who I haven't seen since we graduated. I met a fraternity brother tonight who I haven't seen in several years. And I want to encourage everybody to come to Oral Cornell events we have in town. We have many of them, and we have a great time, okay?
So we still need to
now see. I'll shift into the topic for the evening.
Okay.
I got divorced from the practice wife about 20 years ago. And I spent a lot of my children's inheritance when they moved 800 miles away by still staying involved with my children. I got to see them every month or every 6 weeks, talked to them on the phone constantly. When I remarried my wonderful wife, Liz, now, she became a friend to my children. So actually, they have three hopefully wonderful parents to raise them. Of course, we benefit because the kids thought of Liz as a friend, so they told her everything, which she immediately told me, which I immediately told my ex-wife,
okay.
You know, which the kids didn't know until a couple of years ago, which helped raise them. And anyway, I appreciate a lot of what you're doing, and I think it's wonderful. A lot of what you're saying tonight, here's my question, it seems to parallel the message that Bill Cosby is putting out, and I was curious if you had any relationship with Bill Cosby and if you were ever teaming together on some of this, because it's wonderful work and I want it to continue.
Right, no, I haven't. I've read some of his things, but no, we don't have a relationship.
I would encourage you to reach out to him. I think he would respond to the Chief Justice of Georgia if you wanted to do things
okay,
together.
Okay, I might give him a buzz. Okay, thank you. Thank you. So I'm putting my hand up because we're trying to get this light. I can't even see. Thank you.
Justice Sears, my name is Frank Goldman, class of 87. I'm going to change the topic on you a little bit. You had recently given some testimony or provided a speech with respect to judicial pay.
Yes.
And I was wondering if you could spend a minute or two commenting, reflecting on that issue, because as I'm sure you know, it's a challenge here, not only in Georgia, but throughout the country. So I was hoping you might be able to provide a minute or two of comment on that.
I'll be glad to. I'm sure most people here aren't lawyers and aren't that interested, but I'm the Chief Justice of Georgia, and that's fairly high up in the Georgia judiciary. And I'll tell you, I now make less than a starting lawyer at a large law firm right now. And that's not unusual. You know, that's my colleagues on the Supreme Court, my colleagues on the Court of Appeals. We have an average of about 25 years of experience. And while the guy who just graduated from Harvard or Virginia or Duke or what have you is brilliant, most of them can't even find their way with the GPS system to the courthouse, you know. And I know it's their market forces and that kind of thing, but we do need to give our judges a... I had a difficult time putting my children through college on the wages that I make, but I'm committed to the job that I do. If my son hadn't gotten a full scholarship to Virginia, I don't know what I would have done. So, okay. But I'm paying for my daughter, though. Anyway, yeah. You know, you only get so much good luck. Yeah. Yes.
Hi, I'm John Nixon, class of 53. And these, are there organizations in Atlanta, some nonprofit organizations that are working toward improving or encouraging marriage?
Yes.
And what are those? Well, and how can we get involved with those?
There's Families First. There are just a lot of community organizations all throughout the country now that are getting this on the radar screen. I think it's being heard. You know, the whole fatherlessness issue. We went through a time when I think a lot of women, a lot of people thought that women could just rear, if you had enough money and, you know, enough resources and a nice uncle who could drop in from time to time, you could rear a child yourself. And you can do that, but fathers provide something very important. And the research is showing that marriage is something a little bit special because for those of you who are divorced, you might know this, marriage connects a man to the woman, to the child. You know, that's what so many of the studies are showing. So many men provide so much more when they're married to the mother of their children. Okay? So, yes. It can't always work out that way, though, so I do understand that. Okay, yes.
I'm Susan Kalis, class of 1980, and we've actually met before you were on the Superior Court.
Okay,
so that's been. In many wonderful articles that have been written about you, and you alluded to it just now, your childhood was impacted by the civil rights movement. I came to Cornell the fall after you graduated, and in my 4 years, as I look back on it, Cornell was politically pretty, it was apathetic. I mean, there was just no political interest.
You came in the 80s then.
The fall of 76
when
I started.
Okay.
And so I was wondering what Cornell was like for you in a political sense, the civil rights movement, or was it charged, and what was your experience?
Okay, now remember, I am 52. Okay, so I'm not a civil rights, you know, march, you know, lunch counter person. I'm married to a man who is 68, who is from Georgia, went to Clark Atlanta University, who sat in at the lunch counters and joined the Peace Corps, and he was in all that whole activist. I went to Cornell in 1972. I consider myself the affirmative action generation, okay? I was a middle class woman. Father was an Army colonel, didn't suffer for any money. Grew up, I never went to a black school except for 1 year when I was growing up, okay? 1 year when my parents thought it was important that I spend 1 year in a black school. So they put me in a black school just to experience it. And then my last year of high school, we lived in a white Jewish neighborhood in Savannah, Georgia, that was bussed. They bussed the Jews and us because it was messy back then, and they figured that Jewish students would integrate better with black students. So I got on a bus and was bused to a black school my senior year. Okay, I'm telling you that you ask. I was so fed up, not with the integration. It was just I was tired of being a pawn. I wanted to learn. And I really felt that I spent much of my whole upbringing teaching people what black was, and I just got tired. I just wanted to be comfortable. You know, when you're in an all-white school, who do you go to the prom? It just was too hard. And there were too many ignorant questions. My hair, how does my hair braid? And I just wanted to be comfortable. So I got as far out of, I applied to Cornell because of the gorges in the brochure. So keep the, way far up. My father was a colonel, real strict. I just wanted to go. So when I was 16 years old, I got enough credits. I didn't do a senior year, really. I doubled up in junior year, and I got out, went to Cornell. And the first thing I did, this was very natural at Cornell then, all the blacks, because it was a black and white thing then, just gathered together. And I was always in a historically black college at Cornell. I sat at the black table, ate with the black, lived in Warry House 3 years, partied at Ujamaa, but it was so great for me. Because Cornell was so, you know, whatever you wanted to be, you could be. And it was a feast for me. And I needed to learn about what it meant to be black. I learned all that at Cornell because I was left alone. And I went to the Black Studies Center, and here I am today. It was good for me. So it may look funny, but I was learning a lot, and I was relaxing. And I was just, you know, I didn't have to struggle so much. The putting it together, sort of forcing the kids together, had made the place look better, but it wasn't. I just needed to be among my own for a while. Just like when I was first on the court, I was me at 36. I was a 36-year-old Supreme Court justice. The average age of the guys was 60. I'm serious. When I first got to the court, I mean, I was sweating, you know. And I had some female groups, links and AKAs and all. Boy, I would sit there on the weekends just being so happy just to meet among women. Just, you know, it's not that I didn't like what I was doing. I just needed to be someplace where, you know, I could relax. Does that make any sense? Okay. Was it racist, or I didn't hate anybody, still don't. And so that's what it was.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay, I'll move over here.
Good evening, my name is Sherelle Matthews Baldwin, and I am a domestic mediator at Fulton County in the family court. So I see firsthand, Justice Sears, what happens relative to divorce. I mean, in any given day, you've got 15 or 20 cases in each of the courts, divorce. And as a mediator, as a domestic mediator, it's my responsibility to see if I can help the parties reach their own agreement without the judge making the decision.
Right.
And I got to tell you, one of my catches for the dad and the mom to come together is over the children. And as much as they may fight in terms of this divorce and pointing fingers every which way, when I bring them back to the children, I see in the father's eyes, in their speech, in their heart, they love their children.
That's good.
And the one thing that I wish that they knew is how to sort of take another road before they got to divorce. And I'm not so sure that many families know that. Because in marriage, for those of you who've maybe been through more than one, you close up when your marriage isn't going well. You don't ask for help. And so often, not asking for help or not knowing where to go, I think leads or makes the path to divorce even that much quicker.
Right.
And I really wish that there was some way that families in crisis knew or understood that there was availability for help.
Well, I don't think there is. There's not much. You know, let me just say, we're starting in the fall a pilot court, a new kind of pilot court, where it may be Gwinnett, but it may be someplace else where...
I'm in Fulton.
Okay, we can't do it in Fulton. I was in Fulton. It takes a lot of money to put something, but where there are more services. Maybe we can save some marriages, and for those marriages we cannot save, the divorce will go down a little bit easier. We're bringing in many more experts. Because, you know, I really don't think divorces belong in courts, but that's radical. That's real radical, so I won't be radical, right?
Yeah, we do many mediations. I mean, you know, many of the actual divorces, as you say, get done in 31 days because of mediation and not necessarily because of, you know, a judge got involved. But, I just say to you in doing your work, if somehow families in crisis could know that there's, you know, without paying a private practitioner, because that's what many families also say is that, you know, we just didn't have the money to go to counseling. You know, so I just, you know, put that out there for you. If you can make that available in your work for people to know and understand there are resources. Because dads love their kids. They truly do. And I see it in their eyes, and I think that they would stay if they could work it out for the sake of their children.
Right. Let me just say this. The average cost of divorce, of one divorce in Georgia now is $35,000. Just for, now, you know, many of us can afford that, but most people can't. So, you know. Yes, ma'am.
I'm Lynn Wurzburg, ILR 87, and I want to first thank you for coming tonight and for not taking your mom's advice and going ahead and taking on this topic.
Thank you. Would you call? No, she said. Thank you.
And speaking as the daughter of a great dad who stayed married to my mom and the wife of a great husband, Frank Goldman, sitting up there, who is a great dad to his daughter, I wholeheartedly agree. I think fathers in the home matter enormously. And I'm wondering, in your work, what legal strategies have you seen or begun experimenting with that would help fathers of families in crisis stay with the home and in the home, including your radical idea to take divorce out of the courts? I'd love to hear you get radical.
Well, you know, thank you. A lot of the problems is resources, counseling, jobs. You know, there's just lots of studies. There was a study, a Princeton study. You may be familiar with this. I think the Brookings Institute, or, I'm not quite sure that, where I think 100 poor women were studied with who had children. And their idea is, or their thought process, why do you have children and not, are you or not married? And many of them thought they were ill-equipped to be wives. They could be a mother, but being a wife took more work, and I would agree with that. But, you know, that's one thing we, you know, you have to have the confidence that you can be a partner and walk beside him and be a support, and you have to know that that's a good mating strategy, that you need to keep that father close to you for the children. It's just not, we've gotten into a cultural thing where it's just not even thought of anymore. People don't even think about it. I mean, are you finding that? I'm finding that all, particularly among young women. They don't even understand what I'm talking. That I talk about marriage and people change it to families to be more politically. And then I say, no, I don't mean families. I mean marriage. You know, marriage. Families. Marriage. You know, it's one of the reasons I put marriage as the commission. Everyone wanted me to say family so we could include everybody. And but I want strong families, but I want strong marriages too. Be they your first marriage or your second marriage, or you know. And I want to see these bonds formed. So
thank you.
Okay.
Thank you so much for your comments. I'm Jim Van Buren. I'm class of 55 and medical school in 59. And I can tell you that doing a lot of years of primary care medicine here in Atlanta. I've seen an awful lot of really tough women who have been single moms who have raised their kids, worried, and struggled. The question I have, and we were blessed in my family in that my wife, who is also a Cornellian and couldn't be here tonight, and we've just had our 50th wedding anniversary, which was great, but and we had five kids, which was great, and my wife was a stay-at-home mom, which I think made a big difference with our kids. And I wondered if you would comment about the present state where so many families, and probably most families, have got to have two people working to be able to maintain the economics of their household, and what this this means to the family dynamics.
Yeah, it's difficult. Yeah, you know, I encourage everybody, people who can, even if you have two people working, to try to live not on two incomes. But unfortunately, far too many people have to have two people to work. But I think, you know, I don't really know. I come from a tradition. I am an African American, and black women have worked outside the home and in the home for years. And there have been very few black. My mother always worked. She taught school for many years, and her mother always worked, and her mother before that always worked. So I've never really seen that. I think a stay-at-home mom is fine, and I certainly respect that choice, and I think it's good if you can afford that, and that's great. I don't think it's a must do. I think it's a privilege. It's very, very rare in the world, if you look around the world, where you can have a woman who can stay at home and just take care. You go to Africa, they're farming and taking care of it. Most women, you know, you do many, many things. So I'm not convinced that's a must do. And I know most people cannot afford that. But if you can, I think that's good. I've commented many times that I think it was an extreme burden going up in the judiciary, having my children. I was always juggling more balls, and I do still think it's harder for women than for men, because PBS interviewed me one night for a series one night. I'm sitting on a trial in a murder case thinking about, or at least my mind flits to, you know, why didn't unthaw the roast? Flits back, you know. Who's going to pick up my daughter? And flits back, I don't know if it's something about women or what. Maybe you, the women, can help me. But I always felt like I had my husband in that instance would have just ordered pizza and forgotten about it. So I just always felt more guilt or what have you. And it's been my own personal. And I felt I had to do more. Even as a daughter now, I have I'm Chief Justice of Georgia. I have a husband. I have two children. I do these kinds of things on nights off that are not off. It's just a lot of balls to have to juggle. And you know, I'll get a call, just bringing up my mother again, she will call me at the office in a way that she would never call my brother, who is a Naval Academy graduate, Stanford Law School graduate and all, and say, Leah, there's a sale at Macy's on white blouses. I swear to God, and I'm doing Chief Justice stuff. You know, I mean, I'm not a... But I do think that just women expect their daughters, you know, why didn't you pick up Brennan at the so-and-so, you know, or they're fighting, are you going to do something? And I think women are really, I'm expected to get up off the bench and handle this and sort of intruded on, ask more of in terms of family than men are. I would never, she would never call my brother and would have never called my father to do. In fact, I was never to call my father at work to, you know, it would be too much on. He's earning a living. So, okay, yes.
My name's Tyler Tatum, class of 97. Thanks for coming out.
Oh, thank you.
My question is tied to the fact that I feel like in our society, we tend to have templates for things. You're expected to get married. You're expected to have kids in some, to some extent. It's in every TV program, it's publicized, and yeah, we don't live it, but it's a, kind of this model for living that we have.
Do you think so now? Because I don't know one show where people are getting married, and
I think
even now?
If you ask people why they have kids, most people never thought about it. They just did it because that's what you do.
Okay.
And so my argument is, should we make it easier or harder to get married and easier to find birth control, because that seems to go at the beginning of the problem instead of the end of the problem. Once people are married and they never took the time to think about why they got married, they didn't take time to really understand each other before they got married, and now they're in a difficult situation where they really don't match.
Yeah. Well,
and
I
they have kids because their parents ask about it, and the people who, I know people who have decided not to have kids and are married, and they have a really tough road because they get questioned on it all the time. But they made conscious decisions knowing, you know, that it was a bad decision for them to have kids. So.
Let me say this. Let me pat this. I don't think you should have to get married. It's fine to be single. It's good to be single if that's what you want, that you have to have children. No one has to have children. You know, I can't stop your parents from pressing on you. Or, you know, they're going to press on you. You just have to have your own mind and live your own life. And, you know, people can choose whatever life. I think what I'm trying to encourage is if you get married, it is a serious undertaking. And it should be entered into very seriously and not dropped when you wake up one morning and you don't feel self-actualized or something. Like, it's a serious undertaking. And if you enter that serious undertaking, and if you have children, you should think about your children before you think about your set need for self-actualization or whatever. Because we are in a generation where adults think of their needs first. You know, when I was growing up, marriages were child-centered. Right now, they're only adult, they're adult-centered. You know, what do I need? I feel bad. I'm not happy. I'm sick of that. I've had so many people, well, I'm just not happy. Well, heck, you can't be happy all the time. You have three children. They won't be happy either. Do you see what otherwise, you know, I'm not trying to get anybody in a box. And it's up to you whether you get in a box. I never got in any box that I didn't want to. You know, you just have to be strong, I guess. My mother wanted me to teach school, you know, and didn't get in the box. Yes.
Hey, I'm Alice Tarkington. And marriage means commitment and choice. And I think that in society today, we're ignoring those two fundamental facts. And so my question is, when we look at the availability of pornography on the internet and how it is influencing our children, but it's also influencing marriages, where people make choices, personal choices to engage in that, and then the ramifications are larger. So should we be looking at how those things influence marriage as opposed to just saying you should get married or not?
I don't have an answer for that. You're saying pornography is influencing the breakup of marriage?
I think it is, yes.
I think some people might say it might be helpful. I'm sorry, I have to be cheap. I mean, I don't know, you know. This is beyond me. I mean, you mean like an obsessive pornography kind?
Well,
somebody who spends a lot? I don't know. This is just...
Yeah, no, the question is, I guess, about choice. that people are making choices.
Well, you know, I think this is how I...
children.
I guess what I'm trying to say is, my personal feeling, but I'm not an expert on this, whatever, you know, if you're married, whatever you all are happy, whatever you're comfortable with is your marriage. You know, not all marriages are alike. And once going back to that other question, you can't put every marriage in a box. And I think there are some couples who do all sorts of different things together, and they seem to be happy with that.
But the point is that the availability of that, okay, and how it influences children and how it influences culture.
Well, I don't think children need to be anywhere near pornography.
Right.
If that's your question.
Right.
Okay, not at all. But I don't, you're saying they're...
So it's a larger issue that, you know, as adults we have free will to choose that, but if it's a pervasive thing in society, children are introduced to it, whether, you know, if they're just Googling. So, you know, I think that has some influence on what we're seeing in the way of divorce,
okay,
and family breakup.
Okay. Right.
Justice Sears,
yes.
You've been so gracious with your time. If you don't mind, we'll just have this as the last question,
okay,
for the evening.
Okay.
My name is Gwen Walsh. I want to thank you for coming. I've heard you speak before.
Come up just a little bit so I can hear you.
My name is Gwen Walsh. I want to thank you for coming. And I agree with you that marriage is important and that children need a father in the home. But do you think that part of the problem is the lack of available black men who are willing to commit themselves to marriage?
Yes. Part of a problem, it's a multi-layered problem. There are many, many problems. And then you have to go further in the black community. Why are there a lack of available black men? It's jobs, economics, education. It's very complicated. You know, it's not that I just won't commit. It's complicated. I mean, for some it may be, but for others it's a little bit more complicated. Okay?
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you all very much. I enjoyed this. Thank you. Okay.
Again, my name is Frank Goldman. I am a former president of the Alumni Association here in Atlanta and a proud alum of the university, class of 87 and class of 94 for the law school. And I want to thank you, Justice Sears, for your time this evening. It was a tremendous presentation on some important institutions here in Georgia and throughout the country. And on behalf of the Alumni Association and on behalf of all the folks down from Ithaca, I want to thank you and present you with a couple of items to as part of our gratitude.
Thank you. Thank you.
So, yeah, sure, please.
Thank you.
It's a
The Science of Ball. Oh, great.
By Professor Brainerd.
This will be great because I got very interested.
And then this is a Cornell bracelet, I understand.
Oh,
we won't open it there, but it will
Wonderful.
Give you a token of this evening and, of course, of your time in Ithaca.
Thank you so
Thank
much.
You.
Appreciate it. I enjoyed it.